This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
More and more students in the U.S. and around the world are choosing to take a gap year, a 12-month break from school between high school and college to travel and experience the world. In fact, there is one country now that is actively encouraging those students to come on down and take that gap year with them.
The aim of gap year is really to prepare you for life, to make you more independent, and be ready for the world.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation about Masa Israel Journey. We'll also talk to a scientist who authored a study about how some scientists are exaggerating the results of their studies. And we'll spend an academic minute with some gift-giving attempts that didn't quite work out. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Most students who go to college start school the fall after they graduate high school. But some, and there are more and more doing this every year, opt to take a year off to travel or volunteer or just take a break. Israel has decided they want those students taking that year over there. The Israeli government started a program called Masa Israel Journey to attract students from around the world to the Jewish state for a year of learning and service. Tamar Zilberschatz is the director of Gap Year and Service Programs at Masa Israel Journey. I spoke to her recently about the Gap Year program.
So when we say Gap Year, we basically mean a path that participants want to take from finishing their high school and going to higher education. It can be volunteering, it could be study, it can be doing internship, it could be something organized, something not organized. Basically a path between high school and higher education.
And why is it that most students who do this?
So this is definitely a trend. It exists more in the past in England, some in Australia, but it's definitely a trend in the U.S. now to choose to do a gap year after high school. And when we interview our participants, we hear from them that it's really them wanting to have time to travel, to see other cultures, to kind of like taste what they want to do in the future, to check what is it like to live independently, to meet other people, to do something else for themselves before they're going to the intense college years.
Well, let's talk about the program you're representing now from Masa Israel Journey. This has been going on since 2004, right? Over a dozen years.
Right. Masa Israel Journey was established in 2004 by the Prime Minister Office and the Government of Israel. This was together with the Jewish Agency. And basically, Masa Israel Journey is the leader for immersive international experiences in Israel for young adults between the ages of 18 to 30. And we offer not just gap year programs. We also offer study abroad programs and internships for post-college and service learning programs. So basically, the gap year is a segment and program that we offer under our umbrella.
And when students come to take a gap year with you, what are they doing? Who are they working with?
So this is interesting, and this is really what the gap year represents in our eyes. They get to decide what they want to do and where they want to do it in Israel. We offer various of options. They can do volunteer work in different communities of Israel. It can be doing some coexistence with the Arab population. It could be working with immigrants in different parts of Israel, if it's in the periphery or maybe more central. It can be living in a kibbutz and understanding what this community is all about. It can be internship if they want to really focus on their professional career and path and want to check their talent or their path in their career. So they really have the option to taste what is it like, the world of working, if it's in a big firm or maybe it's a small one. And maybe I'll say something about that, because in Israel it works. Like for us hearing internship, maybe everyone will think that it's maybe to serve coffee or to do some copies, obviously when you don't have the education or maybe the experience needed. But here in Israel, when they come with the native English language, and if they come with a motivation, and they usually come, they really get to be part of really cool projects. Some of even working with the CEO of a big company, and it's like how the culture works here in Israel. So they really get to taste what is it like to work in the specific firm that they're going to, and really get to gain experience that will easily translate into their CV and to their future choices.
Can you think of one or two projects that have been very successful for students over the years?
Yeah, so I can give a really cool example that happened this year for two of our participants, a gap year participant. One of them was from England, and if I'm not mistaken, the second one was from Australia. They both did their internship in this hub in Tel Aviv University that is focusing on technology. And during the year of internship, they had this Tel Aviv University hub had kind of like a hackathon. Not sure if you're familiar with this term. It's like an intense 2 days, which brings professionals from the specific field to work on a specific project. And the hackathon was, the subject of it was doing using technology with food and creating something that will prevent food getting lost or something like that. And their supervisor told the two participants, you should join the hackathon. And they were like, you sure? It's only for professionals. And they said, you can learn a lot from it, go and be there. So they went to this hackathon, and they created a team with professionals with like over 20 years of experience. And the first prize was something around $800,000 to create a project. And they started with an idea of using cucumbers for face cream and things like that. I'm not really an expert in the specific, but the bottom line was that they won. And that was a huge thing in Tel Aviv University Hub. And for them, it was really big and news, and something that was really meaningful for them and obviously for their career, because it's something that they can definitely write in their CV to shoot success. And that was, I think, those are kind of like the stories that I think only can happen here in Israel, the opportunity that they was given and the fact that they took it and they won the first prize. So that was pretty big. The second thing that I can remember is that we had another participant who interned in this channel news in Israel. It's called I-24. And he was really good. He had the talent. And in the end of the year, of the semester, it was a five-month program, they offered him a position. They offered him a job. They told him, if you are willing to stay, we want you in our company. You have the talent. So for him, he stayed for a few more months just to get another experience because this was his passion. So that was another success story of how an intern who is 18 years old without much of experience and not academic and not professional can reach really high and get a lot of opportunities here in Israel.
Those are some great examples. Now, this is it's a government-run program?
It's a government-run program, yes. Masa Israel Journey is an umbrella organization, and we work with a lot of like NGOs, universities in Israel who are running the programs in the field.
So here's a question. Did you take a gap year?
That's interesting. I didn't take a gap year because I didn't really have the opportunity, but here in Israel, we're doing either the army or national service. So I did national service, and I worked with youth at risk for a year, and that was definitely kind of a gap year. It wasn't structured as a gap year. I had more, like, less of things I needed to choose and more responsibility, but it definitely prepared me for life. And this is, I think, what's the aim of gap year is really to prepare you to life, to make you more independent, more able to make your own decisions, be ready for the world. And this is definitely something that we hear from students that are doing the gap year. But now, more than ever, also from universities that are encouraging their students to go and take a gap year and to come to the university where they are more mature and more knowing what they want. And we see also in percentage of statistics that the people that are doing a gap year are less likely to change the subject that they choose after a year and are more successful in what they're doing.
Do students in any of these programs get some college credit for them?
Of course, of course. Again, as I said before, it's really what you want, and we have a variety of options. So you will find in some of our internship programs for gap year students the option of gaining credits if it's with courses in an institute in Israel or with another college that's providing the courses. Or if you want something that is really intense, you can do some kind of a university semester before you start in college and really gain a lot of credits that will ease your first year in university.
Okay, the question everybody is thinking right now, how do you pay for this? How does a student pay for this?
So, as I mentioned before, this is a government organization, and we have funding for those who are eligible for this program. You'll find it really depends on what you wish to do. Some programs are more expensive than others, but you can definitely, there's a big range of programs that you can find something that will fit to you and to your ability and resources.
So how far in advance does a student have to apply for this?
Some, again, we have a lot of programs, so some of them are more competitive, and you will need to decide at least 6 months in advance, but some are more open and more flexible, and if you're a good fit, they will take you in.
All right. What didn't I ask you that people should know?
This is a smart decision for parents. Yeah, maybe if the parents are listening, and I'm assuming they are, we know when we hear a lot from parents how much they're happy after getting their kids back home after a semester or a year, they see the difference, they see how mature they are, and they tell us they were some of them were very suspicious at the beginning because, as you said before, A, it costs money, B, you're sending your kid maybe for the first time away from home, but getting your kid back when he is more mature, more knowing what he wants, and have a lot of experience in his backpack now, facing the world, so they're very satisfied with the decision of sending them to Israel.
Tamar Zilberschatz is the director of Gap Year and Service Programs at Masa Israel Journey. You can learn more at masaisrael.org, and we'll have a link to that on our page, too. Still to come, some scientific and medical reports come with a good deal of spin. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Systematic reviews of available scientific literature are key components in developing evidence-based guidelines and policies. If this data or its interpretations are flawed, well, so are the resulting medical practice recommendations. When applied to diagnostic accuracy studies, this can lead to negative impacts on patients in the form of both misdiagnosis and overdiagnosis. An article to be published in the August 2017 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry provides insight into the magnitude of how often spin or overinterpretation occurs in systematic reviews on diagnostic accuracy studies. The corresponding author of that article is Dr. Matthew McGinnis, a radiologist in the divisions of abdominal and chest radiology in the Department of Medical Imaging at the Ottawa Hospital. Dr. McGinnis is also deputy editor of the Journal of Magnetic Resonance Imaging and an associate editor for radiology. We spoke about the topic, and I asked Dr. McGinnis about the importance of so-called harmonization or standardization of these reports.
Well, spin is a phenomenon where authors of studies are overly optimistic about their study results. So they'll say this drug works really well when the results don't actually necessarily reflect that. And we know that that's a phenomenon very common in intervention trials for medications. But what we don't know is whether it's common in diagnostic accuracy systematic reviews. And for areas like clinical chemistry or radiology, which is my specialty, diagnostic accuracy research is one of the most common forms of research. So if people are misrepresenting the results of their diagnostic accuracy studies, it can be a problem. And the reason it's a problem is that if, let's say, your United States government reading a systematic review regarding the accuracy of some test, and you read it and you think, well, this has great accuracy, let's fund it, implement it, that can be problematic if they're basing that decision on data that's positively spun and may not reflect the actual accuracy of the test. So in short, if they're thinking a test is great, they implement it, it may cost money because it's not as accurate as it is, so it's money wasted. But more importantly, it could harm patients because let's say you think a test is very good at excluding a disease like cancer, but it's actually not as good as the people using it think, then you can miss diagnoses of cancer. And obviously that's problematic for the patients who are undergoing that test.
What about medical interventions? How might overly optimistic interpretations of medical interventions cause harm?
Well, similarly, so medical interventions, we classically think of that as a type of surgery or a medication that would positively impact patients. So if you're presenting the results regarding a study or a systematic review of a medical intervention, let's say it's surgery for colon cancer, and you're spinning the results saying, oh, it's a great intervention, but you may not be reflecting important side effects like people die during the surgery, then when that is implemented potentially in practice, they'll underestimate the number of deaths or important side effects from that intervention, and the outcomes won't be as good as they thought they would. So you'll have more patient deaths, more side effects, those types of things that can really blunt how well you think an intervention is going to work. Same thing with medications. If you think a medication is great for treating high blood pressure, but it causes important side effects like bleeding in the brain that weren't well reported or weren't reflected in the study report, that again can have really negative impacts on patients who are treated with these medications.
So why does spin and overinterpretation occur?
Well, that's a really complex question. So part of it may be that people and physicians or researchers tend to be inherently optimistic. And really, as a physician, you want your test or intervention to work. So if I'm a radiologist and I'm studying CT, I'm probably inherently biased towards thinking that, yes, CT is great because that's what I use every day. And we may just unconsciously present the results in a way that's more positive than is warranted. I don't think it's often a malicious thing, like people actually want to say it's better than it is, but it may just be a subconscious way of presenting the results that don't reflect some of the problems. So let's say I do a study, a systematic review of CT for appendicitis, and it shows an accuracy of 85%, but in children, it's not as good. I may say in my conclusion that, yes, this is a great test for appendicitis, but I may forget to say it's not great for kids. And then when it's implemented in practice, that group of patients where it may not be as effective may not be recognized. Again, it's often an error of omission or lack of communicating important nuance regarding tests, because sometimes there's certain subgroups of patients for which a test or an intervention might not be effective, or sometimes there's problems with the studies you're using to make your conclusions that might impact that. And often it's a poor communication exercise rather than something that I think is very deliberate and trying to, you know, actively misrepresent. So I don't think the intent is usually there to misrepresent, but the effect is that it is. And I think we need to educate authors, readers, editors, peer reviewers on what spin is. And if we recognize what it is, perhaps we can better prevent it.
So it's not just ego.
I mean, without going into the head of every author who's written these systematic reviews, I really don't think people often intentionally want to misrepresent results. I think it's, again, inherent optimism, subconscious positivity, and myself, as an author of these reviews, I've had to be introspective and look back at some of my reports and realize that perhaps I'm not completely free from spin in my own report. So it certainly changed the way I approach my own reporting of research. So again, awareness is the first step, and education and outreach to prevent this or minimize this, I think, is important. So this is a first step to make people aware of what spin is, how common is it, what are the most common types of spin that we see in these test accuracy reviews. And once we're aware of it, perhaps we can go forward and minimize it or reduce it.
Well, your study found around 70% of systematic reviews of diagnostic accuracy studies contained at least one actual form of overinterpretation. What do we do? What strategies can be implemented to reduce this frequency?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think, as I said in the previous question, I think understanding what spin is and that it's very common in our test accuracy systematic reviews is step one. But certainly awareness is not a solution in and of itself. What we do know is that the most common forms of spin that we identified are saying that a test is good when maybe it's not necessarily as good as we think, saying a test is good but not recognizing that the studies you use may be at high risk of bias, or saying a test is good and not realizing that the test may not be equally good for all groups of patients. Those were the three most common forms. So I think if we start with those three very common forms, and editors like Dr. Rafai at Clinical Chemistry or Dr. Kressel at Radiology that publish a lot of these systematic reviews can be aware of that and maybe educate their reviewers and authors on how to reduce that, that's step one. I think the second step is to have a reporting guideline that's specific for diagnostic test accuracy systematic reviews. There's a lot of nuance and tricky things with this type of systematic review that really needs to be understood and reported correctly. And my group, some of the authors on this paper, are working on such a guideline, which should be released later this year. So hopefully a guideline on how to report these systematic reviews will also provide a framework to reducing this type of behavior.
Dr. Matthew McInnes is a radiologist in the divisions of abdominal and chest radiology in the Department of Medical Imaging at the Ottawa Hospital. Dr. McInnes is also deputy editor for the Journal of Magnetic Resonance Imaging and associate editor of the journal Radiology. His article on this topic will appear in the August 2017 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Everybody likes getting a present most of the time, but there are some really bad gift ideas out there. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We've all received a bad gift or two in our time. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Deborah Y. Cohn, associate professor of marketing at the New York Institute of Technology, breaks down why someone would give without an aim to please the recipient.
U.S. consumers spent $626 billion during a recent gift-giving season, and gifts returned to stores that season totaled $63 billion, or about 10%. The proportion of returns reflects a lot of unsatisfactory gifts. According to my research, many bad gifts are given intentionally by people who don't care about pleasing the recipient. Retailers, for the sake of their brands and their profits, ought to create positive experiences from the bad gifts people receive. Prior gift research has assumed that bad gifts are mistakes, but I've identified five categories of gift giving in which the giver does not aim to please. Gifts that threaten the recipient's self-concept, such as giving a pregnancy test to your childless daughter-in-law. Gifts that mainly benefit the giver, such as a sports fan who gives his wife a big screen television. Gifts explicitly meant to offend, which indicate a deteriorating relationship. Gifts given out of obligation, when you don't know what the recipient would want, or even who the recipient will be. And gifts given to allow the giver to brag or outgift someone else, such as when grandparents give too much and later brag about it. Facing this challenge, marketers and retailers can employ seasonal gift experts to counsel shoppers before they buy. They can also mitigate negative feelings by providing an easy and rewarding way to donate bad gifts to charity. The marketing ideal is no bad gifts at all. But if people end up getting a dud, at least they can have a good experience at the store.
That was Deborah Y. Cohn of the New York Institute of Technology. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments on the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.